Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Ornovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
We're getting down to it, Tom. Down to five contestants. Actually, four plus at this point. The contestants are on their way to Telluride as we speak in the parallel universe where the show is actually being recorded in real time, even though it was probably months ago. And, you know, we're at that point in the season where it's sort of, you know, a lot of really good chefs, and you're picking nits to make distinguishing judgments. And, like, what's going on?
Yeah, I feel like this is almost exactly the same juncture we are at with the NBA season, where it's the dog days. People are getting restless. They're cranky. And they're actually, to extend the metaphor, just like teams are at the trade deadline, having to evaluate their weaknesses and their strengths and try to pick up and clean up all their mistakes. Top Chef guys, they had to do it this week too. Is they had to look at, as one of the challenges, kind of do this montage throughout the season and all that stuff. And it seemed a little bit like filler to me. Not a whole lot went down on this episode. And I'm not a big, like, horror movie person, or I'm not a big like spiritual like ghost guy. So like
neither am I.
This one didn't really light my world on fire.
Yeah, it didn't either. I mean, it seems like so they've established some real themes. And one is that the food this season hasn't been all that good. Like we've seen Tom, I think more than one time now, remark that he's getting better food in Last Chance Kitchen than he is on the big stage and on center court. And that's
to steal a word from you, Kvetch. Is he Kvetching?
He's Kvetching a little bit. He's getting better food in the, you know, I mean, which kind of poses a question. I'm thinking about what Hershey Ash, our friend, said a couple of weeks ago during Restaurant Wars, is that Last Chance Kitchens just requires that you be a cook. And the center court, main stage, whatever you want to call it, requires that you be a chef. And like being a chef's harder than being a cook. And I wonder if the limitations and concentrations of Last Chance Kitchen are just producing better food. But he's, I mean, am I correct that the judges seem to have expressed, I mean, all season long, everybody's a little cranky. Padma wants to know why Fatima's not making better South Asian food. You know, this one's wants to know why, like, the food hasn't been elevated to what a professional chef could do. This is stuff that an amateur chef could do. I just feel like it's been a – it's funny. There's been a lot of harmony in the house itself, but I feel like the judges have been kind of just unimpressed on a wide scale basis. They feel like they're not getting great food.
Yeah, you know, the quick fire, as Tyler Anderson told us early on this podcast, go listen to that podcast. If you have not, Tyler Anderson came on and described like he hates quick fires. And with this one, it seemed, I don't know, way above the creativity threshold for Bruce. And it was clear Bruce is going through the motions. It's been apparent for the last few weeks where, you know, there's been a lot of talk about him and having his first child and the emotional roller coaster of being through that on the road and not being there for the birth of his baby son, Jude. And, you know, he's asked to be creative in this quick fire. And literally he says, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to make up a story that that he's afraid of seeds as a kid. What was that?
Yeah. So just a review for our listeners who for some reason haven't watched the show, but actually listen to us, which is completely deranged. If that is you, is the challenge is they drove the contestants to the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, which is kind of on the doorstep of Rocky Mountain National Park. And it is the site that inspired The Shining. It's this big old hotel that's kind of haunted. Stephen King allegedly had a terrible nightmare that inspired The Shining, and Shining is a kind of iconic horror movie in American pop culture, maybe the most iconic one. And so they had each contestant create a dessert that portrayed their worst nightmare. And you're right, you know, Bruce, and we're going to talk to Bruce Kalman. So hang out if you're just tuning in, because Bruce Kalman will be here shortly.
Yes,
and you know, I just want to cook. You kind of get the feeling that there's certain contestants on the thing. Just let me cook. To which I always wonder, when you're asked to do something thematic, whether it's something from your childhood, whether it's a nightmare, whether it's paying homage to X, Y, or Z, or some sort of narrative nod to your food, are you better off just saying, screw it, I'm going to cook something good. I'm going to completely blow off the challenge's premise. And so long as I don't screw up the food, they might slap me on the wrist for not abiding by the actual nature of the challenge, but they're not really going to send me home or put me on the bottom because, you know, my vision on the plate didn't conform to their requirements. I mean, and that's sort of the great question. Can you really just kind of blow off? Are you better? Like, would Bruce have been better off blowing off the challenge's premise and just doing something that's very red and saying, oh, it's gory?
Yeah. Yeah. And he could have come up with like, when I was a kid, I ate a marble by mistake. And so now every time I eat a seed, I think like, oh my God, I'm chewing on like a marble or a piece of pebbles or something like that. Just to give it like a more convincing, plausible story than, yeah, here's a really delicious plate of food and there are pomegranate seeds in there. And also I was deathly afraid of seeds when I was a kid. Like what? So
I do admire his willingness to completely just lie, because it was just it kind of just didn't inspire him. And I would imagine I might feel the same. I don't even know. I was trying to think of myself. What would I do in that situation? Like, what are my childhood? I have the same childhood nightmares as everybody, which is like you didn't drop the class.
Yes.
Like you didn't drop the class is sort of was my early stage, which was sort of my early stage. My mid-career nightmare is like, I just blowing deadlines, basically.
Yeah.
I'm really boring.
Yeah, I also get the one where you wake up and it's final exam day and you haven't studied and you forgot about the class the entire semester. You're like, oh, I got
it. Right, like you forgot to drop it. Like that was sort of the one.
Yes, exactly. Right. And other childhood, like
I do you have NBA nightmares? Do you have like NBA journalism nightmares?
Oh, yeah. All the time is like when we were in the Heat Index. So we Kevin and I covered the Miami Heat from 2010, that 2010, 2011 season, the big LeBron James movie, Taking His Talents to South Beach season. And I would wake up in the middle of the night like tweeting like a dick pic or tweeting like tweeting like thinking that I tweeted some horrific like inside like knowledge, something I shouldn't have tweeted. And I just wake up in a panic and a sweat in the middle of the night being like, oh my God, that tweet just went out to like hundreds of thousands of people. And now I'm going to be fired. Like I had those, like, I guess I would characterize them as like Deadspin nightmares.
Right.
Like you wake up
and Brett Favre. Yeah.
So that was always my thing was like, I get the sweats in the middle of the night being like, wait a minute. I got to check my phone. And I grab my phone. I put in the password and I'm like, oh, I didn't open up Twitter. So besides that, I think I get the common one when I was a kid, which is like the naked one where you show up to school and somehow you don't have any clothes. Did you get that one ever?
I this is going to sound weird. I'm kind of – I think it's a gay straight thing. I'm not embarrassed about it. Like I'm not a nudist, but I just don't – like the idea of being nude in front of other people and it being embarrassing is just weird to me. Like it's a very millennial sort of weird straight person – problem. Like Bomani Jones, our friend from ESPN, I saw him at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. I was there in 2012 and he was doing a panel in New Orleans about this very thing, about
it was showing like,
he was
up
on there with AJ.
School.
Well, no, he was on a panel with AJ Delario, formerly of Deadspin. And they were talking about, you know, I think the topic was is there, you know, Deadspin historically had a very white staff. Which always made sense because Deadspin was, you know, an entity that geared toward a very, you know, as Bomani said, it's a very Caucasian sensibility and it's okay. He wasn't saying it was racist. He was like, for instance, he's like, you know, one of the things Bomani said is like the idea of being like scandalized by dick pics, which at the time was, you know, Brett Favre and there had been a bunch of others and Odin and the others.
Yep.
He's like, that's a very Caucasian experience. And imagine Bomani's voice here. I'm not going to try to do Bomani's voice. Like, that's
a very Caucasian experience right there.
Right.
Like, I really don't think it's happened to black people. It's not.
Right. And his point was, is that it was something that would be a source of endless amusement and scandalization and something to talk about. Oh my God, Brett Favre, can you believe he texted a dick pic? And I think what he was suggesting is to non-white people, and I would put gay people in this category. It's just like, eh. Whatever. Like, so I never had the naked nightmares because largely it's a weird thing to be stressed out about is like being naked in front of people. Like it's like everybody's got it. Like what's the weird thing? Anyway, so
well,
no, mine
you,
were
you
always.
You've been hiking a whole bunch in your life. Have you had
I
the
have
hiking
the falling
one?
Ones? The falling ones. Yeah. Like falling is there something like from like great heights is a total nightmare I've had. Like woken up. Yeah. That one I've had. Anyway, so they did this. Chef Chris comes out with like the most macabre, crazy ass, like a gingerbread man looking like a crime scene, like the cover of the Clockers novel, like crazy, just bizarro thing, and won the whole thing for it.
Yeah, like Padma kind of looked like a tarot card reader or something. Like she was like, "I love the way your plate looks. It's exactly the way I was looking for." And I was like, "Oh, you are creepy."
Padma was really creepy. This like she conformed to the theme of the entire first half of the show. Like she was creepy.
Yeah, sitting in the corner of that room, yeah. And I think even Chris was it Chris or Bruce who walked in and was like, "Yeah."
No,
this
and it was
is
like
weird.
She'd taken a Secanol or something. It was just really kind of bizarre. And Carrie couldn't get anything. Didn't get all the elements on the plate. Bruce overthought the challenge and ended up with a panna cotta that looked like kind of gore pudding. Adrian did a very lovely job with tree branches and different textures and did a gorgeous plate. And Joe Mustache did an egg yolk ice cream that I am dying to try.
Yeah, that looked good. That looked really good. It didn't look like a shattered egg fetus like he was trying to go for, but it was definitely really – it looked awesome.
Michael Vitaggio at Inc. in Los Angeles, former Top Chef winner, has an egg yolk gnocchi on that menu before. I think Inc. just recently closed, but or maybe it didn't. I think it did. And I'm in general the egg yolk subgenre of food. Not just, oh, an egg yolk is on top of this asparagus with pecorino. I'm talking about like egg yolk as its own standalone thing. Egg yolk ice cream, egg yolk gnocchi. I'm a huge fan of egg yolk things, so I was a big fan. It seems like the larger theme right now, though, in the show is we're sort of divided into the technical chefs, Joe Mustache and Adrian, and the rustic, homey chefs. And I would put Chris, Bruce, and to some extent Carrie, who kind of does her own thing. She's sort of a subgenre of kind of mountain standard cooking, if you will, kind of, you know. And it's sort of that is sort of the two tracks right now. And it looks like the technical people are winning. And I mean, obviously Chris acquitted himself very well in the quick fire, but struggled and finished on the bottom with Bruce in the main event, where there were three very good dishes, apparently cooked for Governor Hickenlooper of Colorado. Sometimes mentioned as a dark horse candidate for the 2020 Democratic nomination, by the way.
He's got to get a better hairpiece than that, though.
Ooh, that's cold, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. I feel like someone who's losing hair, I can say that because he's a brethren of mine. But did that not come off as you? Like, did you not see that? You didn't notice?
Now I'm going to have to totally rewatch. By the way, I mean, can we applaud both of us for kind of taking control of our baldness?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw. I posted on Instagram. I played peekaboo with my island table with my daughter, and I smashed my head on the bottom side of the table, and I was bleeding. It was ugly.
Well, you were like stitches?
No, not stitches, not quite, but I definitely got my bell rung where I was like woozy for a little bit. And then my daughter, who's a year old, she was just laughing at me. So that was fun. It was a very humbling moment as a father. It was like, yep, well, I am just here for the entertainment and the clowning for my daughter here. So right now,
children are merciless, Tom.
I know. So right now, my hairline, my receding hairline is not too sharp because it's now scabbing over. You got the widow's peak going on, so
yeah, it's receding as well. Though I'm at this point, I'm just kind of going for the Tom Colicchio look, basically. It's funny. We talked about Carrie a lot last week, and she's a really interesting contestant. I'm sort of really drawn to Adrian right now because I think there are two kinds of chefs on Top Chef. You get the fully formed juggernauts. You get the Voltaggios. Mei Lin is another one who's just like, she came in and she just crushed start. I'm talking wire to wire, 65 games, put it in the win column. That's who they are. But I think also interesting are the chefs who grow over time. And I'm thinking from Top Chef Boston, I forget which season it was, like Melissa. You know, she was a chef who, you know, didn't pick up a lot of wins, but kind of little by little, but it had enough technical skill to kind of grind her way. Not even so much grind, but played enough error-free ball, but also but still struggled, found herself on the bottom or didn't find herself on the top. And it's been very interesting to watch Adrian, who's gotten beaten up a little bit over the course of the season. They had not enough salt, completely under seasoning. Yeah, this was a good instinct, but you did it wrong. And by her own admission, doing really derivative dishes, stuff that reminded her of things her mentors have done. And watching her kind of come into her own, and she didn't win. She did not win the elimination challenge. That went to Joe Sasto, who seems to have regained his footing and did the most gorgeous pasta. Put the beet greens. We see beet ravioli sometimes. Like we see people put the actual meat of the beet, that maroon, in a ravioli. He decided to use the beet greens and put it into the dough, which created this lovely kind of like earthy green texture. And it was just it was the most gorgeous dish I've seen. Evoke the beet, that maroon and forest green kind of together. It was just a beautiful Colorado plate. I mean, if you were ever going to design a dish to serve to the governor of Colorado, this was it. Like, it's a summer mountainy dish that was hearty, and he wins. But Adrian really, it seemed like, came in a strong second with her monkfish that she paired with a venison jew, as she said, come up with a hearty fish that can stand up to the gaminess. I mean, she just cooked. That was the dish I wanted. That's the dish I would have ordered had those five things been on the menu. And she's really coming into her own. I don't think she's going to win this competition. I think, but what I am now convinced of is she is going to be eliminated very nobly on a day in the next couple of weeks where we had three lovely entrees here. We're at the point in the competition where it's the small things. And I think it's nice to see that. I think when she does get eliminated, it's going to be on a small thing, not a big thing.
Yeah, and she lesson with the seasoning and the salt. She still hasn't won yet. She's gone 10 rounds without a victory, which almost seems mathematically impossible. But she's got basically two highs, two finishing in the top three in the last 3 weeks. So she's got some momentum coming in here, a little bit of momentum.
She is a very particular kind of contestant and kind of archetype of Top Chef contestant. Again, they grow over time, kind of find your voice over the course of the season through air. You're not placing first a lot, but you are sort of, you know, you are consistently cooking food, maybe picking up a quick fire now and then. But it's nice to see her two out of the last three, you know, finish up top, and she's just making her best food when it matters the most.
And you know what? Monkfish might be in my nightmare category. That is a scary looking fish. When she grabbed it off the shelf, I was like, oh, it's disgusting looking.
But I do love, do you like eating it? And I love ankimo. Yes. The monkfish liver is like one of my absolute with ponzu. And I actually made it here and I had to like take a tweezers. And I went down to the fish market and got monkfish liver one day at like 6 a.m. where they do all the fish from the port in Los Angeles. And it's where all the chefs go and Japanese restaurants go get their fish down in Skid Row and here in Los Angeles. And I was very ambitious. I actually bought like this big schlong of monkfish liver, which is a terrible image. I'm sorry. And
I
washed it in sake and in soy and really had to boil. And you have to take these ugly ass veins out of the monkfish liver. And then you do that foil thing that you see they do, and you have to steam it. Like I put it in and I made it for the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. Andrew Hahn is actually, if you go on Andrew Hahn, our friend Andrew Hahn, on his Instagram, he took a lovely photograph of my ankimo with ponzu and scallion. So I've made monkfish liver. I've never actually made monkfish. And that just, it's fun to see a chef kind of develop. It's you know, over time. It's like watching Donovan Mitchell come into his own or something. I mean, she might not be that talented, but the project of not just seeing great chefs, but seeing chefs that have really nice attributes, but, you know, don't really put it together to the final weeks. And so that's been fun. Carrie continues, because I got to say, I looked at that plate when it came out. I'm like, oh, this might be the week she goes home.
Yeah.
And then it turns out she gets real simple. I mean, they were like kind of three component parts, but the shishito blueberry, like she's just really smart at keeping kind of hearty food, but with a twist. There's always this one twist, never more than one.
She brings in the spice again from the, the habanero eggs Benedict from a few episodes. She's not afraid to bring in some spice.
The shishito with the blueberry compote, though. I think it was a compote. I mean, just there's always one little twist with her. And it's funny. And at times, yo, it's unambitious kale salad or what did Joe Sesto say, let's say a couple times, I'm not doing, what did she do that or the toast?
Yep.
And yet there's always enough of a twist to elevate it, but never too much. She's kind of the anti Mustache Joe in many respects, but it's working. The two bottom finishers were Bruce and Chris. Chris, inexplicably. So there were two things that were just the two chefs who finished on the bottom did two completely inexplicable cardinal sin things, which was Chris decides for the first time in his life he's going to make pasta. Can you imagine?
What the hell, Chris?
What are you thinking, Chris?
You went all, like the whole season, it's cook my food, do my food. And then right here, when there's five people left, you decide I'm going to do things I've never done before and just wing it.
Really amazing. And then Bruce, the ultimate Charlie Brown football. It wasn't risotto, but decides he's going to do barley in lieu of risotto or in lieu of pasta. It's undercooked. I think the stress, that stress was compounded kind of by he got into a rush. I oversalted the barley. He overrested the duck probably because he had to attend to the barley. And Bruce gets eliminated, which is just a shocker. And we're going to have him very, very shortly.
Yeah, I felt like Bruce was ready to go. You know, they came back to Last Chance Kitchen and Tom Colicchio asked him, you want to win this thing? And he's like, yeah, I do. I think I want to win this. But really, it kind of felt like he said it many, many times on the show. He just wanted to go see his kid. And, you know, you could see the energy, the creative energy just completely get sucked out of him over the last few weeks. And I got to imagine that was really hard because I know he wants – no one goes on Top Chef wanting to lose.
Can we settle something once and for all because it came up with Tanya's elimination? you're still held hostage. You don't get to go home. You got to go into the bullpen and into the peanut gallery. Like, they don't let you, they don't put you on a plane.
We got to ask him that, because when he got kicked off of Last Chance Kitchen, which, spoiler alert, when he did that, he was like, now I get to go see my kid. I don't really, we're going to have to ask him that.
Yeah. And again, I don't know that, you know, we're going to pull back the curtain on this, but oh, there's Bruce Kalman. Should we call Bruce Kalman?
Let's do it. Kevin, I don't know if you saw this. Well, you had to have seen it because you've talked about it. The Pack Your Knives t-shirt from Cotton Bureau.
I am very excited about the Cotton Bureau Pack Your Knives t-shirts. I am all over the gymnasium gray. I am about to order about a dozen of them for people in my life. I am taking orders from loved ones on size. If you are a fan of the show, I imagine having a Pack Your Knives t-shirt is a great conversation piece.
I've gotten one for a couple of the other Leverage the Chat shows, and they're super comfortable. And I know I sound like I'm shilling for Cotton Bureau. But you're not.
You know why? Because I am wearing a Cotton Bureau t-shirt right now. It has the state flag of California on it with a little bear. And I looked in it this morning, and just by coincidence, this is the t-shirt I enjoy wearing around the house. And it is a Cotton Bureau t-shirt. In other words, a t-shirt I would wear even if it did not have like a logo of something I liked on it.
So if you want a t-shirt, all you have to do is go to bit.ly/pykshirt. So that's bit.ly/pykshirt. So that's Pack Your Knife shirt. Or you can hit us up on Twitter. We'll show you the link there. But go get your Cotton Bureau Pack Your Knives merch. You can get, I think it's in 3 different colors. So if you want, if gray is not your thing, we have other colors for that too. And this offer ends soon. So definitely go get yourself a Pack Your Knives shirt. It's super comfortable. I actually, like, now that I'm a dad, and I guess this is a 30 something, when you get in the 30s, you tend to just wear things that are comfortable, you know? You just like comfort. And one of the great things about Cotton Bureau is that they're super comfy.
Yeah, and by the way, by the time you get into your 40s, you just go naked around the house and you don't care. That's basically how it works. But yes,
but how are you going to sell merch that way?
You're not. That's a really poor way to sell merch. Nudism is not good for clothing sales. We agree.
bit.ly/pykshirt. So go get your Pack Your Knives shirt. And go get it now.
We're joined now by Chef Bruce Kalman, executive chef at Union, where Tom and I don't know, I can speak only for myself, Tom, probably the best meal I've had this year.
Well, it was good. It also helped to be highly intoxicated by the end of that.
Yeah, the pairings were well chosen and well consumed. I will say that.
We do that well for sure.
Yeah.
That's actually our secret. We get people fucking hammered, and then they, you know, they remember only the good things. So
there were a lot of good things. The squid ink lamash, still thinking about. The Brussels sprouts with the romesco, still thinking about. To say nothing of the porchetta and everything else, that was wildly extravagant, and it was wonderful to be a guest at Union. I want to ask you a question that I sort of always wonder with well-established chefs, which is, why subject yourself to the indignities of a reality show, whether it's bunking with a bunch of grown men and being, you know, sequestered for days and days at a time? I mean, here you are. You've gotten recognition from the Beard Awards. You have, you know, essentially succeeded in every American time zone in a grand capacity. What's in it for you to go on Top Chef?
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
You know, I had to put a lot of thought into it because I've done a lot of competition shows. And after the last one I did, I said, I'm never doing it ever again. And so I decided to do the one that's the most grueling. but, you know, I consulted with Brooke Williamson and Michael Voltaggio because they were kind of, you know, on me about, you know, hey, you should really do this. And so we had conversations about why, like, why would I do it? And, you know, the reality is that a few things, you know, in this industry, especially this day and age, it's so important to remain relevant.
Yep.
And, you know, that kind of publicity, doing that show, I mean, if you compare the amount of exposure I got, if you monetize that, I mean, I don't think I could ever afford that kind of PR. You know, to pay somebody. And it's pretty incredible, and it gets butts in seats. And, you know, it's about promoting a brand. And I feel like, you know, what I've done on that show is represent myself really well as a professional, as a good person. I didn't get involved into too much of the drama, and not that there was a lot to begin with, but, you know, I feel like it's important on a show like that. It's almost as important as winning, you know, and doing well on the show is always keeping your head up high and, you know, having dignity.
Are you seeing a difference on, you know, after the holidays, the dog days of winter, if you will, are you seeing a difference on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at Union, January and February?
Big time.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, big time. And, you know, it's exciting. You know, it's exciting. It's an exciting show. You know, I used to really want to do it, like, you know, way back in the day. I mean, like, when they were still doing like season 4 and 5, I'm like, oh, I'd love to do that show. And, you know, it was just, now was my time, I guess. And it was definitely challenging, you know. And I think too, it's kind of like, if I don't do it now, I won't do it. And, you know, it really taught me a lot about myself, and it pushed me in ways I haven't been pushed before. So, you know, I think all in all, it was a really incredible experience. I made some amazing friends, and, you know, my biggest fear going into it was that it was going to be a house full of ass clowns, and, you know, and which
it was, but in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not in a way that's like, you know, I've seen people doing stupid pranks, like wiping chocolate on the toilet seats and shit like that. Like, I just don't have the time or patience for that kind of junk. It's stupid. You know, it's childish. And I'm, you know, glad that I, you know, instantly latched on with, you know, Tyler and Joe and these guys. And, you know, we're still like close. you know.
So your Twitter profile, the banner, I think is a picture from the show when you found out that Joe Flam was eliminated. Is that right?
Yeah.
Why did you choose that? That's so touching to me.
I think it really embodies like where we were at that point in time. You know, I mean, I tell you, having done a bunch of other shows, I've done shows where mostly it's like you're there for like one day.
Even
Best New Restaurant, like, you know, when you watch an episode, it was a couple different challenges, like one in the restaurant, one in New York on the same episode. But we really don't spend a lot of time with the other people, not like this, you know, and you really get close with these people for better or worse. And where it's like, yeah, of course, you know, people, you want everybody else to go home so you fucking win. But but at the same time, it's like, you know, and it's not like we're never going to see them again, but it's still emotional. You know, it's like, you know, Joe, he's undoubtedly like one of the most loved guys that was in the house, you know, and he's just such a great person and fun and funny and caring and, you know, and he's a good hugger. So like, you know, it was definitely emotional. I mean, it would have been if any of those guys went home, you know, especially when it got down to that point where it's like top eight, top seven, anybody goes home and it's an emotional thing, you know?
Yeah. And I got to imagine, because you went through such a big life moment too, with your son Jude being born while you were out in Denver on the show. It kind of felt like to me, Bruce, that your mental energy was sapped by the end. And in the confessionals, you said as much, is just, I want to go home. Did you feel like your heart was in it at the end there when you had so much family life going on back home?
I mean, my heart was in it, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like when you're, you know, like going into the restaurant, you have to leave your shit at the door and not bring your personal. But this is very different, you know, and it's not only that I didn't get to meet him yet. It's a grueling shooting schedule. And it's the time that I would have, you know, to be able to call or do a FaceTime and see him was far and few between. So and it got to a point where every moment that I was able to do a FaceTime, he was asleep, you know, and it's like, it's one thing.
So
for me,
cruel,
which
welcome to being a father.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so it was one of those things where, you know, I think if like we already had a kid and it was another baby, it would have been different. But this was like, my wife and I have been on this journey for a really long time. And I've dreamed of the day forever of having a child. And then now, you know, the other thing is the original C-section was scheduled for June 19th and we wrapped the next day. So I would have been home, you know, a couple of days after, and he ended up, you know, being born a month early.
Oh, wow.
So that's where things got a little funky for me. And it just got really hard. I didn't think it would, but it really did. And not only that, but how taxing it was for my wife to have to deal with all of that stuff without me being there. You know, it's a lot. And, you know, not to mention it's an adoption situation. So there was a ton of legal and logistical stuff that had to get done. And, you know, like I remember she, you know, like basically the rules were we could do phone calls when we were only at the house, which wasn't often, to be honest. And so there was a point where, like, to get him to be released from the hospital, she needed some information from me, to where, like, she had producers, and I can't remember which challenge it was after, maybe the Olympic challenge. They pulled me out of the stew room and got me on the phone, because I had to answer these questions. They were personal questions that needed to be answered about my family and all that kind of stuff for him, in order for him to be released from the hospital.
And then you had to go to the judges' table.
And then I had to go to the stable.
Oh, man.
It was a good episode, though. I think it was that one. I think it was the Olympics. But in any event, you know, it was definitely trying. The whole thing is just trying, you know, and you know, tack on that. I mean, the anxiety and stress we all had, all of us. I mean, there was nobody there that was like calm, cool, and collected while we were waiting outside the kitchen to be called in, you know?
Yeah.
And, so it's, you know, things like that. I mean, it's just so many things piled on top that makes it difficult to where you just, I definitely didn't phone it in. I didn't throw in the towel. I just made poor decisions. And in yesterday's episode, it kind of steamrolled from the barley, basically the barley issue I was having, started to panic. And I think if I was in the right headspace, I would have made a different decision. I would have not put it on the plate. I would have adjusted my dish on the fly, and you know, even though it was on the menu that way, I would have explained what happened and said I didn't want to serve this to you because it wasn't right. So here's what I'm serving you.
Yeah. Question: and, did you have to declare the barley ahead of time? Like, had you walked out and with you know and done something to supplement the plate so the duck was still featured, obviously, but you didn't have the barley? Would they have said, "Where's your barley?" Or do they not really know what you're doing?
No, it was on the menu. Okay. They had a menu. However, you know, again, after every episode while we were there, we were like, I should have done this. I could have done this better. You know, should have, could have, would have. And we always look back in retrospect. And, you know, looking back on it now, I'm like, I should have just left it off. I mean, at the end of the day, they're not judging you on what the, you know, menu adherence. They're judging you on how does the food taste. Okay. And so had I left the barley off and just focused on the other parts of the dish, I probably would be in a different place.
Do we count the barley fiasco as does this belong in the risotto curse category? Or is there a subgenre of the risotto curse category?
I mean, as soon as Bruce said the word risotto, I shed a tear. I was like, oh no, he's out. He's gone.
Forget it.
It's funny because on Best New Restaurant, when I did Best New Restaurant, I did uni risotto for one of the challenges, but I nailed it. And Tom loved it.
Amar did an Udi risotto in the finals. Though he didn't win the final, I think he got huge marks for his Udi. That was the one successful risotto, I think, on Top Chef. Was like Amar's Udi risotto, if I'm correct. Maybe I'm getting my things.
What happened with me was basically the night before when we prepped, I wanted to toast the barley and give it a nice toasty flavor. Mm-hmm. And it was already a dry product. And then by putting it in the oven, I dried it out even further. And what I should have done was soak it overnight, but I didn't. And then couple that with the altitude, everything takes longer to cook. Water boils at a lower temperature. So I cooked that barley for almost an hour and a half and it was still not cooked. So, anyway,
Bruce, how did you get over your seed nightmare as a kid?
That was a good story. I know I said this, but I don't work that way. And I never have. You can't say to me, make a dish based on the color yellow. I'll be like, okay, it's going to have egg yolk and something else yellow. And you know, like I don't work. My brain does not work that way. And so I think that whole thing definitely threw me too.
Know that going into the show? Like, shit, I got to come up with like these weird narratives for my dishes.
Oh no, I made that shit up on the fly. I I saw what was in the kitchen and I'm like, this will be a good, stupid story, you know? But, that dish sucked. I mean, it was the worst thing I made in the entire season.
Hey, so you kind of bring up an interesting point. I wonder if, Joe Sasto says something that chefs often say in the outtakes, which is, hey, food is about telling a story. And I kind of imagine Bruce Kalman in his mind saying, no, food's about food. that we ascribe too much narrative to this, that it's a journey. Like, no, you pick ingredients and you cook. And I kind of got the sense there were times on the show you were impatient with the sort of, you know, the restraints or some stupid narrative story that needed to be told. It's just like, let me just fucking cook.
And I tell you what helped Chris. I know Chris and I talked about this, so I have no problem saying it. But his story is what, for the most part, like sold the judges on his dish. He was the only, like, they were basically like, he's the only one that, you know, another chef, you know, inspiring him to do these things. But, you know, I'm not.
Ty goes to the runner on that one. Ty goes to the storyteller on that one.
Exactly. And you know, that show, it's a mind fuck, that show, a lot of times. It really is. And it's, you know, putting not a great dish together, but something that adheres to the challenge and really truly adheres to the challenge. That was a lot of the stuff I had issues with from time to time, in the beginning anyway. And, you know, it's not just about that. It's not just about making a great plate of food, but it has to make sense for that challenge. And, you know, it was definitely a great experience, but, you know, I prefer to make a dish and have it tell you a story. Like, it reminds you of this time when you were a kid and this happened. That's more what I go for. And if you don't get that out of it, then you just get a great plate of food, and that should be enough.
I asked before you came on, I asked some of our Twitter followers if they had any questions for you, and Rapetzel, at Rapetzel, asks, did it feel harder to compete with so many existing judges' relationships, almost like there's more to lose than other contestants fighting for initial recognition? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, that's in my own head, though, you know, and it's funny because, like, while I was there, I felt like Tom was kind of giving me the cold shoulder a lot, and I know Tom, and maybe that's why I felt that way, and maybe he was in a way, you know, to kind of, you know, separate that relationship. I mean, we're not like buddies.
Like overcompensating.
Yeah, we don't call each other every freaking day or anything. I mean, but when I see him, we talk, you know, and he's an amazing guy, you know. But I think that a lot of that was in my head, because when I watch the show, I don't see that. You know what I mean? And I think I just put that pressure on myself, really, you know, and I don't think everybody asks me those questions. Like, you know, do you think they judged you harder? Maybe I felt like they did, but I don't think they did. You know, I think that they, yeah, I mean, you know, I think where it plays against me is that they know what I can do food wise. They've tasted what I cook, and, you know, when they get something that's not up to par, then they, you know, in their head, they're probably comparing it to that.
Tom's coming to town. We're going to watch next week's episode in my living room. We're both getting back. We're both getting in Los Angeles on Thursday, me back from a trip, he coming. I want to take him for dinner afterwards. Now, I am in Echo Park, so, you know, I could go to Calmaire or try another Top Chef Los Angeles restaurant, but, you know, probably prefer to stay Hollywood and East downtown. By the way, doesn't have to do something chefy. I could take him out to San Gabriel Valley, and do like a beef roll or something, or dumplings. Right. So where am I taking Tom on Thursday night after our show?
Have you been to Park's Barbecue in K-Town?
I was just there for a friend's birthday party. That's a good one. You know what?
It's a really good one.
That could be good. It's just such a zoo.
Yeah. But that's why.
Like, are we going to wait for an hour and a half? Like, I don't wait. That's kind of my thing. I don't wait.
Yeah, no.
I don't wait.
I feel you there. I get impatient.
Man, I don't wait. I will book a reservation at 10 a.m. when the moment that Ludo's tickets go on sale. And I'll be like I'll do whatever is necessary to get the reservation and set my alarm. But, like, yeah. I don't want to wait.
Yeah. What about downtown?
I'm 5 minutes away.
Broken Spanish is awesome.
You like Broken Spanish? Yeah, okay.
I like that one's by LA Live, right?
Yeah, it's right by Staples, man. You can walk to the game from there.
And I don't know how late it's open, but Charles Avalia has Rice Bar. It's tiny.
Love Rice Bar. I went there for lunch. I always go there for lunch. That's just a lovely lunch situation.
It's He's great too. He's an awesome guy.
Those are great bowls. I mean, that is just my favorite lunches in Los Angeles. I'm with you.
Barama, really good.
I love Barama. Except my only complaint with Barama is they took the goat off the menu. They took the guy. He takes the goat off. You take the goat off the menu.
Right. Have you been to Badmash?
I'm sorry?
Badmash.
Oh, up on Bunker Hill. Near the, up there. That's Indian.
Yeah, they're right by Viviana.
Yeah. That's another good option. All right, I'm going to come up with something good for Tom. I got to impress Tom.
Yeah. You usually are really good at this, so you have high expectations.
Have you been to Pine and Crane in Silver Lake?
I have been to Pine and Crane in Silver Lake for kind of Asian standards, kind of reinvented in
a casual setting. Is there anywhere you haven't
been? No, I'll tell you, I have not. You know what I'm doing? I'm doing on the 20th, actually, a couple days after I see Thomas, I'm finally doing Vespertine, kind of a birthday-ish kind of treat celebration, and at those prices it better be really freaking good.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I feel I haven't been to Felix yet. I haven't been to a lot of the places over in Venice and Santa Monica.
Felix is awesome.
Is it?
Yeah, Felix is fantastic.
Might be a little bit of a schlep depending on where Tom's staying, but we can do that. Anyway, this is boring for our listeners.
Kind of can I ask Bruce, when you guys did like the dad Olympics where you had change a diaper and stuff, like as a new dad myself, I have a 12-month-old here. What was the most fun or some of the things that was on the cutting room floor during that surprise that once you found out you were going to be a dad, like what were the cool things there?
The best thing that we did, which I can't believe they didn't show, was they had a bunch of diapers with numbers on them and they melted candy bars inside.
Oh no.
And you had to guess the candy bar. You open it up, it looks like a diaper full of poop. And that was kind of fun. And then we did a baby food blind tasting, and I won.
Congrats. We were just talking about this the last episode, Bruce, is what are some of our favorite challenges on Top Chef, and the blind taste test ones, both Lynn and Kevin, you're big fans of it. And that was kind of it. They should have shown that, the blind taste test and trying to snuff out the diaper candy bar.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Way better than the diaper changing race, but it's all good. That was fun. I was happy that was nice of them to do that.
There was the milk. What was the milk? The bottle thing you had to drink Bloody Marys out of the bottle.
Not us.
Yeah.
It was hard to drink out of them, so we just we ended up screwing the caps off and just drinking out of them.
What's next for you? Union's rocking. You got anything else in the work?
I'm part of this new project called the House of Machines. It's opening in the Arts District, and it's a really hip concept. They have a couple abroad, one in Cape Town, South Africa, and one in Niseko in Japan, the ski village. And it's this really cool concept where, like, I own the kitchen. We have doing breakfast, lunch, dinner. There's a amazing cocktail bar. Bad Birdie is her handle on Instagram, Amanda Collum. She is phenomenal mixologist, and we're doing these really awesome cocktails aged in oak barrels. And then we have coffee from Evil Twin Coffee in South Africa. And then we had this dude, LA Speed Shop, Chris Richardson. He's building motorcycles on site. And we have a partner with Fender, and we're going to have live music. And we have an event space and a cool speakeasy. And it's such a really cool place. It's, you know, all about rock and roll and motorcycles and tattoos. And, you know, the thing I love about it the most is that people are going to come in here and get food that they're not expecting.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, Bruce, because, like, that's not a food-first kind of venue, right? I mean, it's a community space. It's this, that, or the other. You're a chef. So, I mean, how do we what's so appealing about it to you?
Because I like the idea of this fun, casual atmosphere that brings people in. It's definitely going to draw people in. I mean, I'm here right now, and people walking by, everybody pops their head in here because it looks so bitchin'. And you know, I'm going to do what I do and serve the food I serve. And I think the idea of serving food like that in a non-traditional environment is pretty cool. It's a great brand. I mean, they have great branding and it's a great group of people.
Can you bring in Tyler to do some punk rock music?
Absolutely. Definitely.
How often have you seen those guys or the chef testants? You saw them on the opening night? Do I have that right? That you guys all got together for the opening? Yeah, and then you went out to go see Fatih and do the Cachon, right? Was that you?
Yeah, we did. We went out there to do dinner with James Beard House, me, Tyler, and Joe. And we did a dinner, Goldilocks and the Three Bears, at the Beard House. And Tyler's pastry chef, Kristen, was Goldilocks. And so we did that dinner. And we did, while we were there, we were judges on Cachon. And then we also shot the Harry Connick Jr. show and did porridge three ways, you know, too hot, too cold, and just right. So, which is one of the dishes we did for the Beard House. And then Tyler.
Which is the gimmick that you did on Last Chance Kitchen, too, or Tom did.
Kind of, yeah, exactly. And then myself, Tyler, and Fatih are doing a lunch together at Pebble Beach Food and Wine. And then we're going to go directly to Rogelio's restaurant and do a dinner with all of us and Brother Luck. And so we've got a bunch of things we're working on. I know Joe Flam and I are going to do a dinner together in April in Chicago. And I know Joe and Joe are doing a Joe Squared. Yeah, they're doing a Joe Down Throwdown or something they call it at Spiaggia. And so it's fun. You know, it's cool. I like that. We all from day one, most of us clicked, you know, and you can see it on the show. You can see the camaraderie and, you know, we're kind of like, we had discussions about it. We're all like, you know, let's win this fair and square. You know, let's all do this together. Let's, you know, cause you see, you know, people in the past, you know, throwing each other, you know, in putting each other in bad situations and, you know, jeopardizing things. And, you know, this was more of, hey, you got, you know, helping each other out. And I really like that because that makes it, you know, it just makes it more fun. It feels better to be there, you know.
Tom, doesn't it sound like Byron Scott or some of the old timers like Charles Barkley should be bitching about how contestants now, there's too much camaraderie
too nice.
On the show.
Too nice.
Remember when a rivalry on Top Chef was a rivalry and chefs hated each other back in the day? It was better.
Too much AAU ball.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Bruce, this is really exciting. I'm going to bring my partner up to Union very soon because I was sort of crowing about that meal for a couple of weeks and I need to bring him up. And
yeah, well,
I will let you know when that happens. But you've been very kind to join us and we've loved watching you on the show and it's been a fun season.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Bruce.